Thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ.
Welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Katie Langston, and we have a wonderful treat for you today. I'm here with Dr. Cameron Howard in her office, very fancy office at Luther Seminary, where I am a student. Dr. Howard is an Old Testament professor. We're going to be talking today about the Bible and empire, which, if it doesn't sound exciting, is very exciting. You should know that. I got to take a whole semester on it, which was awesome, but you'll have to get by with, I guess, just an hour of some of the basic concepts. But anyway, welcome, Dr. Howard. Thanks. You so much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. And that was the first time ever that my office has been called fancy.
Well,
that was generous.
It's very beautiful. Cool. So why don't you just, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, your specialties, and so on.
Yeah, well, I've been teaching at Luther for, well, this is my fifth year, and I did my PhD at Emory University in Atlanta, and it was there, actually through taking some courses in the English department, even as I was doing my PhD in Hebrew Bible, that I started thinking about the Bible as post-colonial literature. That is, the courses I took were reading particularly 20th century fiction coming out of countries that had been colonized in the European colonization efforts of the last 400 years, mm-hmm. give or take. Mm-hmm. And as I started to read those novels, that poetry, I thought, gosh, some of the same themes that are taking hold in postcolonial literature are also present in the Bible, and specifically post-colonialism, post-colonial theory, which really did arise as sort of literary theory or mm-hmm. in those disciplines, has as one of its central ideas that there is no part of culture that is left untouched by the relationship between colonizer and colonized. Mm-hmm. So any kind of art, music, literature, if it comes out of a place where the power relationship between empire and colony or colonizer and colonized has been present, whether it comes from the sort of upper echelons of people who had power or if it rises up out of those who had been colonized, no matter where you find it, it's going to affect the cultural output mm-hmm. of a people or of a nation or a region. So that it's not just a matter of politics or a matter of socioeconomics or something like that, mm-hmm. but that all literature is affected. Well, the Bible, ancient Israel was never not under some sort of influence, be it sort of outright colonization or some lesser degree of being a tributary state or something mm-hmm. of larger ancient Near Eastern empires. So there's a lot still to be mined in terms of thinking about the Bible in those ways. New Testament studies has really been at the forefront of thinking about imperial relationships mm. and biblical interpretation. But the thing about the New Testament is that you pretty much just work with Rome.
Right.
You just have one.
An empire.
Right. So, yeah, an empire. But when you read the Hebrew Bible or yeah. the Old Testament, you get to see the way that ancient Israel was affected by multiple mm. empires over hundreds and hundreds of years. And you have so many texts that represent so many different moments in time that you also have a wonderful collection of texts that both show accommodation to empire, mm. like in Isaiah, hey, Cyrus, the Persian emperor, he's the Messiah, Mashiach, the anointed one in Isaiah 45. And so maybe this empire is a great thing, but then you also have texts of resistance. Mm-hmm. I talk about some of the diaspora literature like Daniel or Esther or even the Joseph narrative as resistance literature. So you don't have just one relationship between the Bible and empire, particularly in the Hebrew Bible. It's very nuanced. There's a lot of sides to the story that are contained within the scriptures.
So there are a couple of things that you said, and then maybe let's unpack them just a little bit for the listeners. First of all, let's talk a little bit about when you say colonized and colonizer, like what does that mean? And then a second thing that I think will be, we did just touch on it a little bit though, you know, is this idea, I think that for some of our listeners, it will be new or newish to even consider that, like, the Bible itself isn't a monolith, that there are different things going on, different people with different perspectives writing at different points in time. So maybe we can touch on that just a little bit as well. Yeah.
So the language of colonizer and colonized, in some ways is shorthand. I mean, in any imperial relationship, in any empire, people are not always going to be, clearly, you know, people who have power or lack power, right? I mean, people, can be functionaries within a system in ways where they don't have a lot of power, but they've got more power than others. So I just want to say from the get-go that colonizer and colonized are sort of shorthand or placeholders for talking about this imperial relationship. Uh-huh. But I don't mean to say that the power situations within empires aren't quite nuanced and difficult.
It's complicated.
Yeah. So maybe first it would be helpful to distinguish, well, just to define these terms.
Yeah.
So imperialism and colonialism are two that are very closely related, but not exactly equivalent. So when I think about empire, what is an empire or what is imperialism? The key word for me is thinking about extraction, relationships of extraction. I find that that's a helpful way to think about empires across time because there are some significant differences between how empires operated in the first millennium BC, or, you know, the 18th, 19th century AD.
Right.
Those are very different, times and contexts and technologies, but no matter where you are in history, empires work by trying to extract resources from the periphery to the center. Huh. So the center, is the empire. It's the seat of power and it is always wanting to expand. Hmm. If you think about the British Empire, for instance, you know, the saying, the sun never sets on the British Empire,
that it
was proud of having conquered you know, huge swaths of the world.
Right.
So this geographical territory, but its center was in Great Britain.
Right.
And, it would, in order to maintain a military presence in various places in the world, it needs to be able to feed those armies and to feed those armies. It's got to have control of fields and farms and people sending in money and food to those armies. So, the center needs the resources from the periphery to conquer the periphery. It's sort of a self-perpetuating, idea that you know, the bigger you get, the more you need. So you have to get bigger.
Right.
So in terms of geography, there's that element of empire, extraction, human resources, natural resources, economic resources. There are other elements of imperialism that are frequently present, if not universally. One is military conquest. You know, just talking about conquering territories, so you need armies to do that. Although some people would talk about or have talked about multinational corporations today as being empires, which may not have sort of traditional armies in the way we would think of in terms of sovereign nations having armies, but
they have armies of lobbyists.
Yeah, lobbyists. Or they have security forces.
Yeah.
Or they, anyway, that's a another can of worms.
Right.
But just say that empire, particularly after the decolonization movements of the 20th century and the withdrawal of European powers from those imperial relationships, doesn't mean that the kind of extractive relationships we would associate with empire aren't necessarily
still at play.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got it.
They could could talk about them that way. Anyway.
Got it.
A lot of empires want to win hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. That is, they, if you're going to rule a lot of people, to make them feel like it's in their benefit to be ruled.
Mm-hmm.
And so propaganda or other kind of campaigns to say, hey, this is a good thing that happened to you. That happened in the ancient world as well as the modern one.
Mm-hmm.
So we can talk about that in terms of the Bible.
Sure.
Assimilation of subjects, that's something that did not happen as much in the ancient world, at least until Hellenism. Maybe we could talk about more assimilation with Hellenism, but when we're talking the really more ancient empires relevant to the Bible, like the Neo-Assyrians, the Babylonians, and the Persians, mm-hmm. assimilation was not a huge deal. So nobody was trying to make everybody speak Old Persian,
right?
For instance.
Right.
Whereas, again, I'll refer to the British Empire, there were a lot of efforts to have people speak English all over the world,
mm-hmm.
or I think particularly about the Indian schools in the United
yes.
States, like the Carlisle Indian School, or that's the first one that comes to mind, but there were so many, plenty here, right here in Minnesota.
Yep. And in Utah, where I'm from too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, so that Native children would be taken
yep.
out, forcibly taken from their families. And the idea was to make them as Western and non-Indian
right.
as possible, non-Native American. And so, you know, everything from dress to language to religious traditions. So that's been a part of imperial projects around the world. It was not so much at play in a lot of the ones that we'll talk about, but I feel like it should be mentioned because
mm-hmm.
it's often presented both as a motivation and a goal in empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then every empire brings with it strategies of resistance.
Mm.
So it's part of the framework of empire that opposing these power relationships, there's always going to be within them voices of resistance. And that's particularly true in the Bible. There is resistance, sometimes more overt and sometimes
mm-hmm.
more implicit.
Okay. And that's a nice segue, I think, to the second part of my question, where we talk about, you know, because you had mentioned previously that there are texts of resistance. There are some texts that are praising, perhaps, the empire. So talk just a little bit about that. Maybe you could frame it in terms of, you know, you were kind of started there a little bit talking about the Bible as a response to empire, but maybe just tease that out a little bit more for us, and you know, emphasizing again that there are different voices in the Bible. It's not a single voice,
right? Well, I think the Persian Empire, which is my favorite empire. Not to
favorite
say that I
quotes.
Endorse it,
right,
but I
yeah.
find it the most fascinating
uh-huh.
to study.
Sure.
And it's particularly important for the Hebrew Bible because much of the Hebrew Bible came into being as written texts during the Persian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So Persia, a little bit of history.
Yep.
586 BCE is the Babylonian exile.
Mm-hmm.
So this is when Babylon comes to Judah and destroys the temple in Jerusalem, and the elites of Judah are exiled to Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
It's the pivotal moment discussed in a lot of biblical books, Lamentations perhaps most poignantly. I mean, it's about the siege of Jerusalem and the horrors of war that come with that. And seeing the destruction of the city and the temple, but also we read about it at the very end of Second Kings, Jeremiah, mm-hmm. very much in the midst of that conflict. So it's a really, at least for the scribes who wrote the Bible, the exile is a watershed event in biblical history that really, it introduces a theological crisis. It says, you know, we thought God had promised Abraham land and descendants, and we're in this land, and, you know, we got freed from Egypt to enter into this land, and that we read about at the beginning of Joshua, for instance. We've had a king here. We thought that David was, you know, God's favorite. And a lot of Psalms written about that, right. About God's favor over the king in Jerusalem. And now we don't have king. We don't have the land. What has happened
right.
to the promises
yeah.
that we thought God had made? So, the exile is really important. It's also important because it actually doesn't, the exile itself doesn't last super long, because then in 539, Cyrus of Persia conquers Babylon and allows all of the exiles from Judah to return to Judah and rebuild the temple and reconstitute a community there in the land. And so a key text for, or there are a couple of key texts about this. One is Ezra Nehemiah. Dates from the Persian period describes the Persian period. Uh-huh. So that's a good anchor text to think about. And it contains that edict of Cyrus at the beginning that says, you know, well, let me turn to it here in the Bible. We can say. So Ezra 1, if anybody wants to follow along. Says that in the first year of King Cyrus of Persia, in order that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be accomplished, the Lord stirred up the spirit of King Cyrus of Persia, so that he sent a herald throughout all his kingdom, and also in a written edict declared, thus says King Cyrus of Persia, the Lord, that is Yahweh, the name of God is used there, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth and has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem. Okay, well, that's pretty extraordinary
right.
for its claim. So the Bible says that Cyrus says that Yahweh said, the God of Israel said, the God of Israel made me an emperor, right? Made me king over these multiple nations and gave me instructions to build him a house at Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So we have to wonder, right? Just thinking historically and strategically, King Cyrus, like, is this something he would have said?
Right.
We'll never get into his head about what his actual motivations were. And was he a pious Yahwist? I'm skeptical of that.
Probably not.
But yeah. We have what's called the Cyrus cylinder, which is a little clay cylinder that describes Cyrus's capture of Babylon, in which he says, basically, your god, Babylonians, your favorite god, Marduk, sent me to get rid of your own government who was oppressing you and not worshiping Marduk correctly, and I've come to set things right and I'm liberating you. So it was part of Cyrus's propaganda machine. We know from archaeological evidence that this is the kind of thing he would say when he would take over a particular region. He would invoke the god or gods of that region and say, hey, I like your god, and your god sent me, and he's really happy with me.
Right.
Right. And that kind of claim worked well with ancient Israelite theology that understood their regional god, the regional god of Israel, to be the singular creator of the whole world. You know, all that Genesis 1 and 2 stuff, to make that claim that God, the God of Israel, is the creator of the whole world. And as it narrows, as you go to Genesis 12, the call of Abraham, what happens with this family has an impact on the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very resonant with ancient Israelite theology to be able to say, our God is interested in the general and the particular,
right.
The cosmic and the familial.
Right.
And so it works for Cyrus's agenda. That's all to say that this is probably something that Cyrus would have said, and it was well received by those who were in exile. And we know that because of Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
Isaiah chapters 40 through 55. There is the closest thing to a scholarly consensus you can get among academic biblical scholarship, that what comes in Isaiah 40 and following does not date from Isaiah the prophet in Jerusalem in the 8th century.
Right.
So the Isaiah 40 and 44 and 45, which name Cyrus
right.
by name,
right.
And are describing this era around 539 when Cyrus is making this edict, call Cyrus Mashiach, anointed one. And it was kings in ancient Israel who were anointed.
Yeah.
So it's extraordinary that this non-Israelite is right. given this title
yeah.
of Mashiach, anointed one. And so at least from the perspective of whoever's putting together Isaiah, Cyrus is great news.
Yeah.
So that's one take on it.
Okay.
But if we keep reading, in Nehemiah,
mm-hmm.
Ezra's prayer in Nehemiah 9,
mm-hmm.
which seems to date from later in the Persian period. So whereas Isaiah 539 represents a voice, Isaiah 45 represents uh-huh. a voice from around 539. Nehemiah represents the late 5th century or even early 4th.
So the honeymoon period perhaps had
exactly,
worn off.
Exactly. Yeah. And in recounting the story of Israel's past, it ends at chapter 9, verse 36. With this lament, here we are, slaves to this day, slaves in the land that you gave to our ancestors to enjoy its fruit and its good gifts. Its rich yield goes to the kings whom you have set over us because of our sins. They have power also over our bodies and over our livestock at their pleasure, and we are in great distress. So that mm-hmm. sounds like a very different voice than
yeah.
the voice that said Cyrus is our anointed one. This is a voice that says, our kings, the kings you have set over us because of our sins. So Cyrus is no longer a deliverer, but his subsequent kings then are seen as representatives of a well-deserved oppression in the language of Ezra here. And what have those kings done? They have extracted, right? They've
yeah.
extracted resources. Its rich yield of our land goes to the kings, and they have power over our bodies.
Hmm.
So even human resources, they're explicitly named as being sent from Judah to the king. So that gives, I think there are two things at least to draw from that. One is just an example of the attitude toward the Persian kings is different in Isaiah 45 than it is in Nehemiah 9.
Right.
And I think the difference there is both a passage of time and different authors.
Writers. Right.
Right. So that would be an example of how the Old Testament is multivocal
mm-hmm.
in that way. And it reflects on different moments in time and different people in different places. So there's that.
Yep.
But there's also represented here these multiple perspectives on the idea of empire.
Yeah.
So, and on the idea of kingship, the idea that, maybe this human king, Cyrus, can deliver us. And then it turns out by later in the 5th century that a king is a king and they all do the same thing.
They all screw everyone over.
Yeah. And in fact,
yeah.
one of the best sort of most concise descriptions of extraction
yeah.
as a principle for
yeah.
for empire to me is in 1 Samuel 8.
Uh-huh.
The people of Israel ask Samuel to ask God to give them a king.
Right.
And he says, these are the ways of the king who will rule over you. Kings will take and take and take and take a tenth, take a tenth, take. So there are, what do kings do? They take. And so in the ancient world, these kings who had all of this land, all of this power, were seen as ones who extract. And in that sense, I think there is nothing new under the sun in terms of ancient empires and modern ones. Mm.
So, we've talked a lot about Persia, maybe just really quickly, some of the different empires in the Bible. And I think it's fair to say that they all do that taking thing. They all do the extraction. Yeah. But, maybe to highlight how really the entire story, I would say in the Hebrew Bible as well as in the New Testament, the entire story has this element, because the people, you know, the people of Israel were pretty much always oppressed.
Yeah. No, I think that's fair to say, or at least they were always beholden to an empire in some way or another.
Yeah.
So, of course, the first that I'm sure comes to mind is Egypt and the story of enslavement in Egypt and then the exodus out of Egypt. And, it's hard to talk about that in historical terms because there are very few other sources of evidence about that situation besides the Hebrew Bible. I mean, we have some documents from this era in Egyptian history, but not a lot that sort of says, hey, this happened exactly like it says in the Bible.
Right.
So just as a, from a pure historical standpoint, I would talk about the story that the Bible tells, because that's just one source, and just as a good rule, as any kind of academic historian is going to want at least one more corroborating source, some sort of archaeological or epigraphic evidence. Anyway, but that narrative, is so important, of course, to the description of Israel's past in the Hebrew Bible. So, you know, Deuteronomy is going to say, give the law and say, why are you giving this law? Because you were slaves. And remember, you were slaves in Egypt.
Yeah.
And I delivered you with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. So the experience, or the memory, the collective memory of this experience of enslavement, it's an, you know, sort of the ultimate imperial relationship, and it casts a long shadow over the Hebrew Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe it is best. I was going to think about this historically, but actually just sort of moving canonically instead is probably, it's going to get roughly at the same ideas, but maybe your listeners, most people are a little more familiar with the way it lays out canonically, rather in the Bible, rather than how, you know, it doesn't always line up exactly chronologically, but, you know, you read about the Exodus from Egypt, and the other side of the Exodus from Egypt is then the conquest of Canaan, the entry into the land. And I think I never finished distinguishing between imperialism and colonialism. So imperialism would be this broader relationship of extraction or taking. But colonialism is in many ways a sort of subset of imperialism. That is the foreign people entering a land and claiming it as their own.
Yeah.
And turning it into a colony of that center nation or group. So in the case of Persia, that's not exactly what Persia was doing. What with the repatriation of the Judeans, you know, back into Judah. It's definitely an empire in terms of scale and other measures, but it's not exactly the same.
Got it.
But
So the distinction. So all colonialism is probably arguably imperial, but not all imperialism is colonialism.
Yes. That's very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But what you have described in Joshua is colonization.
Yeah.
That is, it is a land inhabited by people.
Yeah.
And, this other people moves in and takes it by force, and claims it as their own. So in this instance, you know, we said Israel was always, I think you
right.
said, oppressed or
right.
under the influence of empire, and that's true. But the story that's told of taking the land of Canaan sees ancient Israel as the conquering
right.
force.
Yep.
So we'll have to deal with that.
Yeah, we'll circle later. Back to this a little bit. Yeah.
Uh-huh. What do we do with that?
Yeah.
They, as the story goes, you know, have rule, you know, the land is allotted among the tribes, they're ruled by judges. And then when you get the book of Judges is really this sort of downward spiral into lawlessness or depravity or whatever you want to call it. So that some of the most horrifying stories in the Bible come toward the end of Judges. And, the book of Judges ends with this statement, you know, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And the idea there, the implication is that Israel needs a king.
Hmm.
And yet you keep reading into 1 Samuel, you get to bracket out Ruth.
That's, right. It's a whole nother ball of wax. Yep. Right.
You keep reading into 1 Samuel and you get to 1 Samuel 8, which we've already mentioned. And that's where Samuel says, well, God says to Samuel, they already have a king.
Right.
God is their king. But if they want a king, fine, give them one, but first tell them how terrible it's going to be. And
right.
this is how right. terrible it's going to be. These are the ways of the king and the king's take.
Yeah.
And as you keep reading through Samuel and Kings, you can sense this ambivalence about monarchy. So
yeah.
there are some kings who are really great and
right.
God has favor over them. And there are some kings who are terrible. And scholars think, again, another sort of source of there's a lot of scholarly energy around this idea that Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings, all of those to a greater or lesser extent, date from the exile or later, and are trying to explain, make sense of this theological crisis, again, that came
right.
from exile. Why are these promises that God made all the way back to Abraham of land and descendants, particularly the land promise, why is that no longer the case?
Right.
What about the promises to David? Why don't we have a king in our own land? And so some of the kind of commentary that you might sense about it, around it, you know, so-and-so was a terrible king and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and yeah, you know, there's a lot of that.
Uh-huh.
Is part of this trajectory explaining we're in exile because we broke the covenant, because of our apostasies, and the kings led us there.
I see.
So there's this love of kingship and love of, you know, give us a king. We want a king so we can be like other nations, it
right.
says in 1 Samuel 8. And, of course, the text is very pro-Davidic, but it also sees kings as ones who can lead you into sin. And so, you know, I often have my students reflect upon the question, are these books, these historical books, pro-monarchic or anti-monarchic?
And right.
pick a side and argue it. And they
yeah.
can't, they, everybody wants to say, well, both. I mean, of course, that's what I would say too, but I
right.
try to make them
right.
make a case
right.
for
right.
one
right.
way or the other.
Yeah.
So that would also be another example of that, multivocity or the idea that you're getting competing
mm-hmm.
perspectives.
Right.
And that often indicates that you have multiple accounts that are woven together.
Yeah.
Or at least it represents, one group wrestling within itself.
Right.
About the meaning of
right. trying
these historical events.
Trying to make sense of it.
Yeah.
And looking back and weaving a narrative. So that's important.
Right.
I think that's important to keep in mind that those aren't necessarily, contemporary, accounts. I mean, some of them might be.
Right. There might be some records.
Right.
For sort of palace records, but there's also a lot of storytelling
right.
in there.
Particularly
there's
interpreting
in Samuel. Yeah.
of it too, saying, well, that guy, he's one of the reasons why we're here, and that guy, he's
right.
one of the reasons that
right.
why we're here, and
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you also then notice as you read through Samuel and Kings is how difficult the difficulties Israel and Judah face by the nations that surround them. Mm-hmm. So particularly Syria in the north.
Yep.
And Assyria in the east.
Which isn't at all confusing.
Right. Yes. We could say Damascus for Syria so that it's not so confusing. But that those nations, basically, they put a lot of pressure on Israel and Judah. You will recall that there's one Israel until 922.
Right.
So through the reigns of Saul, David, and David expands, and then Solomon, there's one Israel.
Right.
And then after 922, with Solomon's son Rehoboam, there's a split in the kingdom between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah.
Yep.
And there are 10 tribes that go with the north, and only Judah and Benjamin are left in the south, but they're the ones who survive longer.
Yep.
The northern kingdom of Israel is going to fall to Assyria, that is the Neo-Assyrian Empire, in 722.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Kings, in particular, is telling the story of these kings who, you know, some good stuff happened, but also some bad stuff happened, and we're trying to sort all of that out. You can sense the pressures that are put on Israel, particularly Israel has Syria, you know, right up there on its northern side, pressing down on it. And Judah is sometimes insulated from the pressures of Syria because of the northern kingdom of Israel's distance in the middle. But both of them are worried about the Neo-Assyrian Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to make alliances. They have to say, Israel and Judah have to say, well, we're going to pay tribute to Assyria. And so that way, if another nation like Egypt or Syria, Damascus, is going to, you know, try to invade them, then Assyria's got their back.
Mm-hmm.
But if Assyria is on its way out, if it's having a low point or, you know, some sort of decline, and it doesn't have enough resources to come and back up Israel or Judah, then Damascus or someone else can say, well, we're going to try to take this territory.
Right.
So Israel was really caught in a tug of war between the other powers around it throughout its history. And it's really when you get into 1st and 2nd Kings that you start getting that coveted archaeological and epigraphic evidence to sort of back up the idea that, you know, there will be lists of Neo-Assyrian kings and who was paying them tribute.
Yeah.
And there will be kings of Israel or kings of Judah's names on
interesting
lists.
Yeah.
And so that was happening, that very real, you know, we have to pay.
To pay these guys to protect us from those guys.
Exactly. And, but now maybe we should change our allegiances because it looks like these guys are on the outs and these guys have the stronger arm.
Right.
So it was always having to juggle that. So there's that pressure.
Yeah.
The texts that most reflect this period of Neo-Assyrian dominance during the monarchic era of Israel, those texts are the 8th century prophets.
Uh-huh.
So the 8th century prophets are Amos, Hosea, Micah, and then about the first 39 chapters of the book of Isaiah.
Isaiah, right.
So when you read those texts, you can also see, you know, the prophets commented on their day, first and foremost.
Right.
They made any kind of predictions they're doing are coming out of commentary on what they're seeing in their day. And so
you can. And they're deeply political.
Oh, yeah.
Very it's like much this so. Idea that, like, the Bible is apolitical. Like.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, prophets were. It was a job in the ancient Near East you could have was to be a prophet.
And all the gods had prophets, right? Like,
all the kings, yeah.
All the kings, well, yeah, but the other gods too, like the.
Right, exactly.
Like Yahweh had Yahweh's prophets, but then like.
Yes.
The other, like Marduk had Marduk's prophets and all those guys. So it was, the role of prophet was not like singular to Israel. They didn't, Israel exactly. did not invent prophets.
Right. And prophets were usually attached to kings in some way. And they would tell kings, you know, kings would say, well, ask the gods, if I should invade this city state. And if you were a good prophet, you would come back with something very flattering about the king to say, like, you're awesome, king. You're so strong. You're going to win.
Right.
Like this. Right. That's what you said. And so actually the prophets in the Old Testament, we get the impression that they're sort of against the powers, countercultural, and they are. But that was the exception and not the norm for your sort of everyday, day in and day out prophets.
Huh.
Because they were telling kings what they wanted to hear. But the prophets who made it into the Bible, they're the ones, what they said would happen did happen. And usually if they said something bad was happening, that came true. But that was also not what kings
wanted to hear. So, that's interesting.
But the Neo-Assyrian empire's influence is what you read about in those four 8th century prophets primarily. A good example, do we have time to look at an example, is again in Isaiah, in Isaiah 7. So this is a really famous passage because it talks about Emmanuel, God with us. But there's more going on in there. So this passage dates from the middle of, or the beginning of the Syro-Ephraimitic War, which was from 734 to 731. And it was a war between Israel and Judah. But Israel had on its side Damascus in the north. And they were trying to get Judah to join a coalition to fight off Assyria, the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And so at Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1, this gives us, the superscription gives us our date for what we're working with. In the days of Ahaz, son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram, so Aram equals Damascus equals Syria. And King Pekah, son of Remaliah of Israel, those two kings, went up to attack Jerusalem, but could not mount an attack against it. When the house of David, so that's the dynasty in the southern kingdom, Judah, heard that Aram had allied itself with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz, king of Judah, and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. So he's super afraid of Israel and Damascus attacking him again. So then the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz. You and your son share Yashub. It's terrible luck to be a prophet's kid because you got really awkward names like "So Remnant Shall Return."
Right.
Go to meet Ahaz at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the Fuller's Field and say, take heed, be quiet, do not fear. And do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands. Now, I don't have to read every word of that, but that is what's happening there is Isaiah is being sent to tell Ahaz, don't be afraid and don't join in a coalition with Assyria. So Ahaz was going to go to Assyria for help. There's a little bit more about this in around 2 Kings 16 through 20, thereabouts. Ahaz was going to go to Assyria for help, and so make an alliance with them to go against Israel and Damascus. And Ahaz is trying to say, he says at verse 9, you know, if you do not stand firm in faith, you shall not stand at all. It's going to be okay. Don't make any alliances. Just hold out and they're going to fizzle. And so, if we skip ahead to verse 14, Isaiah says to Ahaz, the Lord himself will give you a sign that everything's going to be okay in this war situation. Look, this young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey by the time he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land before whose two kings you are in dread will be deserted. That is to say, look, look at this pregnant woman. She's going to have a baby. This is, she is a sign from God, and this child is a sign from God to remember God is with you. God is with us. Emmanuel is going to be the name of the kid. And before he knows right from wrong, things are going to be prosperous in your land. And these two smoldering stumps of firebrands will have gone away.
Yeah.
And the land will be deserted. Now, Ahaz does not heed Isaiah's advice. But what you get there is in a passage that, you know, we usually hear in an Advent section is really infused with conflict.
Yeah.
Imperial conflict.
Right.
So the ancient empires impact what gets said and negotiated in these prophetic texts. That background, that historical background is very much there.
And it's woven into the text.
Yeah.
So
if we're thinking about the Bible as the product of empire,
right.
So one way to think about it is simply just to acknowledge the places where we can see that historical relationship there and to think about it not simply as, okay, there's Assyria, but what does it mean for it to be an empire?
Yeah.
Is there something about what we know about other empires as these sort of extractive relationships that's changes how we think about it, or at least informs more deeply how we read this historical information. So what are the categories and the questions and the issues that come with empire? And one of those questions or issues would be about assimilation or accommodation versus resistance.
Right.
Do we see in these texts voices that are going along with empire, voices that are resisting empire.
Right.
It also raises the question for us, was ancient Israel an empire?
Yeah.
Because you remember, 1 Samuel 8, the king who rules over you will be like any other king and will extract. And you know, there's this sort of smaller monarchic question. So I think for the scribes who are in charge of writing down these portions of the Hebrew Bible, there was a way in which all kings were the same, whether they were foreign kings or local kings. But then at the same time, you read, like we read in Nehemiah, a sense of the external pressures of being part of something bigger.
Yeah, that's fine.
So let me see what we were saying about. So in 1 Samuel 8, there's this idea that the king of Israel is going to extract, for sure. But there's never a time in which Israel really controls a lot of territory.
Right.
In that kind of geographic or military conquest. I mean, David is a great military leader in his very small territory.
Right.
That is so, and if you look at a map, you know, of the ancient Near East, you can find them for any, when any of the major empires was in power, and Israel and Judah are these tiny little slivers along the sea. Yeah.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the Neo-Assyrian Empire holds this huge swath, or the Persian Empire, you know.
So it's just to put a cap on the empires, and then I have a couple other questions I'll go back to sort of related to this. But so you had Egypt, you had Israel itself had its moments of self-definition. You have Syria and Assyria. Then you have the Babylonians.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're going to defeat the Assyrians. Nineveh, the capital, will fall in 612.
Mm-hmm.
You have the Babylonians.
And they take the southern kingdom into exile.
Right. Because the northern kingdom had already been destroyed. Samaria was destroyed in 722 by the Neo-Assyrians.
Yep. And they took the 10 tribes to the polar ice caps. some of our Mormon listeners will know that joke.
Okay. I didn't get it.
That's all right. There's a rumor that the 10 tribes are still lost, but they're frozen in the polar ice caps.
Oh,
so
I had not heard of that. But after Babylon, is Persia.
Yeah.
And Persia is in place until about 333. It depends on where in the 330s you want to put the ending, according to sort of where Judah is under Hellenistic control, or where the whole rest of it is. But anyway, in the 330s, Alexander
the
Great, and many people will be more familiar perhaps with all of that. There have been movies about Alexander and the Persians right. and all of that. And then the Hellenistic control over Judah lasts until Rome takes over.
Right.
So that's, we've gotten to the end, but the biblical canon, but right. Most texts in the Hebrew Bible date from the exilic and Persian post-exilic era. Though they incorporate other materials, oral traditions, earlier ideas for sure. But in terms of getting written down and edited in the forms we know them now, there are some books that probably date from the Hellenistic era. Some would put Ecclesiastes, Kohelet there. Certainly Daniel would come there because the apocalyptic stuff in Daniel 7 through 12, is a reaction to the persecutions of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Greek king in the second century BC. So there's sometimes you'll hear it called the intertestamental period or better the second temple period would be in there in that transition from Greek to Roman rule and pivot, you know, around the time of Jesus' birth until the Gospels. There's not a lot of, or until Paul and the Gospels, there's not a lot of biblical texts. You really sort of get most of them in place by the 4th century BC.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk about this a couple of things. So first of all, I think when you begin to look at the Bible this way, it really complicates things, or it can complicate things, particularly if you're coming from a perspective where you kind of have this idea that maybe like the Bible dropped out of the sky, like, pristine and, you know, perfect, or that, to a certain extent, the text was maybe dictated by God or something like that. So there is some complication then to recognize that what the text of the Bible is a group of people who are struggling with a very specific set of kind of socio-political realities. But what, you know, what do you think are some, so that can be challenging for some people to begin to think of the Bible in that way, but what do you think are some of the gifts of looking at the Bible that way? Like, how does it maybe, from a, like a practical standpoint on our own, like spiritual journeys, our own faith journeys, how might entering the Bible from this vantage point, give us some insights into our own kind of wrestles?
There are so many ways. So I myself am a person of faith. And so, you know, I'm trained in academic scholarship of the Bible, but I also, just strict intellectual honesty here, you know, consider the Bible to be important for my own life. And I think, one thing that I appreciate about the Bible is in fact the way that it reflects the real struggles of real people that I have today and that many have today about how to live faithfully, and that people have different ideas about what it means to live faithfully. And that somebody, whoever put all these books here together, you know, gathered them together, allowed those different ideas about what it means to be faithful to stand together in the same big book. There wasn't a sort of wholesale erasure of differing opinions, or differing ideas. One example would be attitudes toward outsiders or foreigners. So, in Ezra and Nehemiah, one of the crises coming back was trying to figure out, you know, if we had these sort of genealogical lists about who could be a priest and had these ideas about purity and who was in the community and all of this, how do we know who's in and who's out? I mean, you're coming back, you're trying to sort of reclaim an identity in the land. And so the way that Ezra and Nehemiah deals with part of this is to, people who, men who had married women in Babylon. Yeah. Babylonian women or other foreign women are required, told to expel those women and their children wow. from the community. And that, to me, is a very, very troubling text.
Yeah.
It's not something I want to turn to emulate in some sort of
right
scenario that I try to say is analogous today or something.
Right.
So that's troubling. And then there are a lot of texts in the Bible that are troubling. But also in the Bible is the book of Ruth.
Right.
In which a foreign woman, a right. Moabite woman, becomes ancestor of David. And of course, in the book of Matthew, then ancestor of Jesus.
Right.
In that genealogy in Matthew right. 1 is right. what I'm referring to there. And so that lifts up a foreign woman as essential to the story of the people and probably comes from around the same time that Ezra Nehemiah does. So that Ezra Nehemiah is not the only voice out of that community. And I feel like we have fractures like this today in our faith communities. And this, you know, this is not the issue necessarily, but right. there are lots of different ideas. And I think the Bible, rather than giving us the exact answer to many of those questions, mm-hmm. models the fact or tells us that those deep community conflicts have always been there. And we still have to work to resolve them. And it requires talking to each other. And, it's a struggle.
Right.
It's a story of struggle.
Yeah.
Particularly when it comes to empire.
Yeah.
I think that, the Bible offers us some really interesting models for how to live in oppressive situations.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, the book of Daniel,
yeah.
The first six chapters are these stories where Daniel right. finds himself in these different courts of foreign kings. And, we call this diaspora literature. So, not everybody went back when Persia right. said that the exiled Judeans could go back.
Right.
But not everybody went back. And so, we also have literature that comes, so Ezra and Nehemiah, that's folks who went back. And
right.
So it comes from the land. You have stories like Esther and Daniel where, you find Jews living in other places.
They stayed out. But
right.
but they Babylon still managed to maintain
or
an identity.
Yeah. And yeah. so for Daniel, you know, Daniel and his friends in Daniel 1, how is he going to be distinctive
yeah.
from the culture that has uh-huh. colonized him or that he's beholden to? But how is he going to survive in that empire
yeah.
and yet still have an identity? So the story sets himself apart by refusing to eat the food of the mm-hmm. empire, only eating vegetables. And, then God is with him and he flourishes and he rises to some power.
Mm-hmm.
So in Daniel's case, he's not mounting a revolution against the empire because he's not going to win that. He and his three friends within
right.
the court.
Right.
But he is resisting huh. the empire nonetheless.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of ideas in the Hebrew Bible about what it means to live under empire. You know, and I think it's worthwhile for all of us to reflect on, you know, what kind of imperial relationships do we find ourselves in?
Mm-hmm.
They can be real. Maybe they're real political ones. Maybe they're spiritual ones or metaphorical ones. Maybe we are people with power rather than
yeah.
people who are trying to forge an identity. But I think the Bible talks about those kinds of real on the ground power relationships and working out
mm-hmm.
a faithful identity in the midst of them
mm-hmm.
in many places. Esther, Joseph, Genesis 37
yeah.
through 50, you
yeah.
know, he finds himself
right
in a foreign court. But there are also, as I've mentioned, there are also sort of polemical texts that say we're going to assert who we are in the land over and against other people. And I think all of those are responses to empire one can see throughout history too.
Yeah.
So in that sense, the Bible is just very real.
Right. It's very human.
It is.
Yeah.
I regard the Bible as inspired by the Holy Spirit, but,
me too.
Yeah. Say it's really human.
Right.
When I say it's really human.
Right.
And I agree with that. I do, because I think it reflects real human concerns, concerns about how humans live faithfully for God.
Right.
But that is sometimes a really difficult question to ask, but it's about struggle. And so we see, we get to see different reactions and ways through that struggle. And some of them are going to be really useful and helpful. And some of them are going to be more difficult to wrestle with.
Yeah. Yeah. A couple thoughts occurred to me. One is what's interesting is that we're in a time, our own context is a time where, sometimes people look to the Bible as something of like an answer book. And so when we say that like the Bible is inspired by the Holy Spirit, and what you're hoping that means is that the Bible is an answer book, you kind of have one approach to scripture. Whereas if you look at what the Bible actually seems to be, which is maybe not so much an answer book, but like a question book and a book of wrestling, and then to say that is what, you know, that was inspired by the Holy Spirit, then that sort of gives you a whole different perspective of who God is. That gives you a whole different perspective of the kinds of things that God is like wanting us to do. So I don't know. I find that very fruitful, like coming from, you know, I've shared with you coming from a little bit of a more kind of fundamentalist sort of background or hermeneutic, to be able to still say, no, like the Bible is inspired. These texts, you know, God speaks to us in these texts and so on, but to not necessarily have to have it be like, because in Joshua, they went in and they killed all the people, then that means that, you know, there might come a time that God like wants us to go in and kill all the people. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually think Joshua, I think Joshua is a product of the imaginings of a people who have been oppressed and colonized for a long time.
Right.
That it dates from the exilic or post-exilic, early post-exilic era, and that it is it reflects an imagination where a people who do not have power once had it.
Yeah.
There's, this will be controversial, and we can send people to books. But the excavations, for example, of Jericho, have yielded, no walls at Jericho in the late Bronze Age.
Right.
That would be an example of there's a lot of archaeological corroboration actually for a good bit of the Bible. But not for the conquest story happening the way that it says it happens. And in fact, you know, in Joshua, it will say, we came into this city and killed everybody. And then at the beginning of Judges, it says, but we actually, did not drive out all the inhabitants of this. So there's already within the Bible a sort of undercutting of some of the more comprehensive claims Joshua of the way the conquest looked.
Right.
And so I want to know why tell the story that way? And I think it comes out of that. I think it comes out of that time where, in fact, they are not so successful.
Right.
But imagine, I mean, that same desire, we want a king. We want to be like the other nations.
Right. And this, like, this fantasy that, like, that we have this power. I think that's one of the evils of empire. And we talked about this in class when we read Fanon and that kind of stuff. But, like, you know, this idea that, that those who are under imperial rule fantasize about flipping the tables. And so it kind of just perpetuates these cycles of violence. And to see the book of Joshua and the conquest as the result of the fantasies of those who are, you know, living under oppression is a very, it's a very interesting way to think about it. And it gives you a lot to wrestle with, I think.
Yeah. And yeah, if power only appears in one mode in any given society, why would one not imagine yourself having that power?
Right.
I mean,
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that's a whole other conversation. I'm afraid to start it, or else I won't do it justice.
Because that's a
difficult question, and one that certainly hasn't been solved yet.
Right.
And in the aftermath of colonialism, in recent centuries has has often been a kind of chaos and violence in formerly colonized places. And there's a way that that colonialism itself set that up often.
Yeah, exactly.
But it also begs the question of how we ever break out of those cycles and that
there's no easy answer to that one. No, not at all. One of the things that intrigues me so much about the Bible is I think that despite like the fantasies of Joshua and some of the myths about how awesome David and Solomon were and those sorts of things, I think what you see in the Bible, in both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament over and over and over again, is a fairly weak God.
Hmm.
You have in Yahweh a God who's constantly being conquered. And then in the New Testament, you have a God who dies on a cross. And so for me, it's powerful to think about the idea that the empires of the world and the ways that we think about power as violence and extraction and domination and expansion and the accumulation of resources, is the exact opposite of the kind of power that, quote, the real God shows, right? Mm-hmm. That God, a conquered God, a crucified God, is how God has consistently tried to reveal God's self through the Bible.
I don't know that I totally agree with it.
Okay.
In the Old Testament.
Okay.
Just the assertions of God's cosmic power.
Mm.
Anytime Israel gets defeated, this is where the twist is. And I was sort of alluding to this earlier.
Yeah.
When Israel gets defeated, it's actually not that Yahweh gets defeated. Whereas, you know, in other countries or city states, I should say, if they were defeated, then it was like the patron god of that particular city state was defeated.
Okay.
But I think what, is interesting about the Hebrew Bible is that it's that God is sending those other nations to teach Israel something about its own justice, that's the way that the prophets talk about it. I also come from the Reformed tradition, which is very keen on the sovereignty of God.
Right.
So I think I have an innate tick that is activated by
talk about the weakness of God.
At least in terms of the Old Testament, depictions of God.
Interesting. I like it. So, you know, I think we've touched on this a little bit, but, you know, what would you say are there any takeaways or key questions or things that you ask yourself as you look at the Bible and its relationship with the empires? And then you look at our current kind of political situation. Go ahead and specifically call out current political context. Are there any resonances there? Is there anything that you wrestle with, questions you ask yourself, things that you feel inspired to do or think about in kind of connecting your scholarship with present day, real world kind of thing?
I think about Christian identity as inherently anti-imperial. Mm-hmm. And so that comes from continuing my thought from Old Testament into New, though I think there are anti-imperial elements in the Hebrew Bible as well. But just from my own Christian perspective, I think of I think of Christianity as anti-imperial, or at least that we are called to stand against oppressive structures and to be countercultural in that way. And so in that sense, there, to me, there's not a huge difference this year than last year, than 25 years ago, than 100 years ago, than 400 years ago, because wherever we are as Christians, we are meant to uphold Christian values. It's been very easy. Often the church, and I just mean broadly speaking, Christian church has benefited from and therefore aligns itself with empires, that is, structures that extract, structures that exert power over other people. And we have to resist that temptation, I think, to rest easy in being aligned with any kind of political power whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And to stand on the side of those who are oppressed. The Hebrew prophets help us with this. Mm-hmm. They help us with this because no matter what was happening to ancient Israel or Judah on a macro scale, mm-hmm. they were always calling the leaders of Judah and Israel back to care for the poor. Political leaders, religious leaders, anyone who had any sort of capability and money and power in the system. And they would talk about alliances with, you know, what's happening in the international, on an international scale, as having real impact on people within their nation and the poor especially. And your obligations never change. I think about Micah 6, for example, which is a famous passage. It ends, you know, 6:8, what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God? That passage talks about, I mean, it's this dialogue between, as it's a trial, really, a lawsuit God brings against humanity. What have I done to weary you? And humanity comes back with this, you know, well, what more do you want from us? Like, how many more sacrifices do you want? I think the idea is not that, God wants them to get rid of the sacrificial system, which was the way that God was encountered in ancient Israel, but that they miss the point. They're doing only that, only their religious observance, and they are not doing justice. And so, no matter what's going on, it's not about just showing up in church, but it's about being involved in the world. And that obligation is the same now and in the future and in the past. Mm-hmm. And so we, you know, different Christians will feel that pressure at different, mm-hmm. in different ways at different moments. Mm-hmm. But I think it's always there. And if we're feeling too comfortable, it's just because we've gotten
used to it.
Used to being benefiting from empire.
Mm, yeah.
Empire, remember, doesn't have to be defined in geographic terms or in nation state terms, but anywhere that structure of extraction exists.
I think that's a really useful way of thinking about it and has a lot of critiques for our society. Well, thank you so much. I mean, I know we just scratched the surface on what is an extremely complex and I think very, very rich way of looking at and reading the Bible. I hope that it's given our listeners just a taste. Any like intro books you might recommend or any resources?
Well, sure. Lots of books. I'm always glad to recommend books. There's a new book, relatively new book out called Isaiah and Empire by Leo Perdue and some others. And it's, published by Bloomsbury, I think. So that's, if you like the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament, that's a way to get into the historical backgrounds, but through the lens of empire. Mm-hmm. I can recommend there's a nice reader called In the Shadow of Empire, Reclaiming the Bible as a History of Faithful Resistance, edited by Richard Horsley and published by Westminster John Knox Press. Actually, maybe I'd put that at the top of the list.
Yeah.
Because it has short essays that touch on the different historical moments with Old Testament and New.
We read that in class and it was good.
Yeah. And I would, though, above all, encourage people to read the Bible.
Yep.
Read it. Read it not. Well, try reading it like you would read a novel or poetry. I mean, it's got all those different genres in it.
Right.
So all the tools that you learned in your high school English class for reading literature, like try exercising those tools. Like what's the plot? Whose point of view do you have? Like, who's telling the story?
Yeah.
Who's benefiting from it? I'm of the belief that the questions that we ask of the Bible, the more questions we ask, the more we know, the more that is know in the sense of John Calvin's idea of knowledge of God. And that scripture gives us spectacles to focus and see our knowledge of God, and that we need to ask difficult questions and try different ways of reading, to be expansive in our reading of the Bible, not reductive, because, scripture is a gift. And if we think that we've got it figured out, we need to read it again and something else will jump out. And it's the expansiveness and the exploration and, that study is prayer. Anyway.
That's lovely. Thank you so much for being on Project Zion today, Dr. Howard.
My pleasure.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.